work to do, so I came in early. And you found her, Jennifer? She started to raise her hand, but stopped herself.
Yes, I was doing the 8 p.m. rounds.
Did you have any contact with her earlier in the evening? She nodded. What was she doing?
Reading. She liked to read.
Was she eating or drinking anything?
She had some cookies.
I wondered if Vic had eaten all the evidence. Anything else?
Joe piped up. She always had a glass of Metamucil in the evenings as a fiber supplement.
Who mixed that up for her?
Joe shrugged.
I did. Did she eat or drink anything else that evening? They all looked at each other, and Lewis was the first to speak.
She probably had her dinner at 6 with the rest of the clients.
He looked puzzled.
Do you think something disagreed with her?
I looked at all their faces. Marie Barogia was poisoned. Jennifer crossed herself. Lewis stared at me in shock. And Joe paused and then translated to walks over ice. They all looked sad, but they didn't look like killers. They looked like people that cared a lot and got paid very little for their concern. The Indian woman said something to Joe, who looked at me, shrugged, and translated. She says she will pray for Mrs. Barogia. We all sat there in silence for a moment. The shock was still in Lewis's voice when he spoke.
Walt, this is horrible.
Yep, that's the official view as well. I studied them a while longer. You can see how important this is. They all nodded again. Joe, do you have the Metamucil container? They all joined me in looking at Joe as his eyes widened.
Yes, do you think...
They all looked worried. Images of other patients flopping around on the floor crowded in on them. I don't think there's anything to worry about. The amount of this particular poison wouldn't have an effect on most people. I leaned back in my chair. I'm going to need the can of stuff that was used to mix up her dose for that night. I'm also assuming that her meds would be with her personal effects. Lewis nodded. Were there any glasses or plates left in her room? After a brief conference, it was ascertained that there had been, but that they had all been run through the dishwasher and were now perfectly safe. There didn't seem to be any more questions to ask, so I invited them to go down to the jail to be fingerprinted and called Vic to ask her to accompany them back to the home after she finished to collect the rest of the evidence. It was 4:15, and I had 3/4 of an hour before they read the will, so I punched the intercom. Ruby answered.
Are you through terrifying the people from the old folks' home?
Laugh it up. I'm sending you there next. Do we have anything to eat?
Pot pies in the jail refrigerator.
It didn't sound like it would hit the spot. Vic didn't bring any bread back from the bakery? There was a pause.
No, that would constitute stealing, and we try and refrain from that type of activity within our sheriff's department.
There was a murmuring on the other end.
But somebody just came in, and he says he's willing to buy you a late lunch, early dinner, as long as it doesn't come in a bag.
I put my hat back on and hurried out before the Cheyenne Nation changed his mind. As a precautionary measure, I left my office door open. He was staring at his chicken-fried steak sandwich. The long, dark hair hid his face and muffled his voice. How many murders have we had in this county since you became sheriff? I counted up quickly, then recounted.
5.
3 in the last month?
Yep.
He picked up the sandwich and looked at it. You should retire. Quickly. I chewed on my usual as Dorothy came over and poured us more iced tea.
It's very tempting to go with the lawyers.
They have the most to gain. He growled it the way he always did when talking about violence. Assuming Lana did not beat her own brains out with a tire iron. The chief cook and bottle washer looked over at the brave, and they both nodded. I looked at them and wondered if people in other parts of the country were as smart-ass as the ones that I had to put up with. You two are a lot of help. Dorothy shrugged and went back to work. I took a sip of my iced tea and looked at the bear. He chewed.
Tell me about the timing on naphthalene poisoning.
5 to 20 minutes. So it had to be introduced to the victim less than a half an hour before her death.
Then it had to be someone who saw her at the home that night.
Possibly. But it could have been left for her in some form of consumable. Of course, they washed all the glasses and dishes that were in her room. I turned and caught Dorothy's eye. I need your phone. She brought it over and set it in front of me. I looked at Henry. Why are you in town during a blizzard? He looked out the window behind us.
In case you have not noticed, it has stopped.
I turned, and it had.
I've been kind of busy.
He set the glass down and continued.
I needed filing supplies and discs for the photo collection I am working on.
I went ahead and dialed the number of the jail. How's that going? The lines at the corner of his lips pulled south, pinning his mouth like a pup tent.
The problem with leading Indians is you are never quite sure if they are following or chasing you.
The telephone began ringing. Absaroka County Sheriff's Department, Officer Cesar Vittori speaking. How may I help you? I stared at the phone.
Wow.
I jumped in before he could deliver another spiel. Sancho, it's me. Is Vic around? No, she's done fingerprinting and went with the staff over to the home for assisted living. I had seen her fingerprint before. With her Philadelphia technique, I was pretty sure she was the fastest fingerprinter in the West. How long do you think it'll take you to go through the boxes? I'll be done tonight. That's when his trial period would be over. And I suspected he would hightail it back to Rawlins after that. I waited for a moment and then spoke again. Hey, troop, I want you to know that what you're doing is important and I really appreciate it. He didn't say anything. About Isaac's car, what makes you think somebody fooled with it? There was brake fluid all over the place, and two of the bleeder valves were left just loose enough to leak over a short period of time. He paused for a moment. It was a front wheel and a back one. The car has a two-reservoir master cylinder, so it could only fail if both systems lost pressure. It just seems like too much of a coincidence.
You sound pretty sure.
My father was a shade tree mechanic his whole life. It's something I'd know. I hung up the phone and looked at the bear. He had put a sandwich down but continued to chew.
Was that Anna walks over ice in your office?
I nodded and started to take another bite of mine, but sat it back down. She works at the home. I drank the last of my iced tea and glanced over at Dorothy. She doesn't speak English?
No. Some of the elders believed it diluted your power.
He drew a deep breath.
She did not speak when she saw me.
I continued to look at the 220-pound man who looked like he could have stepped from a Curtis photograph or a Remington oil.
You're kind of hard to miss.
Perhaps. If you get a chance, would you talk to her? It seemed like I was always asking the bear to help me out in an unofficial capacity. I smiled. You speak Crow well enough not to embarrass yourself? He nodded.
Chuak so jatale.
He stood and reached for his long leather coat hanging on the hook behind him, then turned and looked at me as he pulled it over his shoulders.
Anything else?
I was disappointed that he was leaving. I was just remembering the pleasure of his company. I suppose he read my disappointment.
Where are they reading the will?
Gerard and Straub on the corner of Main and Gatchell. He nodded.
Maybe I will stop by.
Bring a lawyer. Everybody else is. His mouth stiffened before he flipped on his wayfarers.
Perhaps I will.
He thumped me on the back and made me spill a little iced tea on my pants. One of the big bronze hands reached out to touch fingertips with Dorothy as she passed him. They did it with the casual assurance of professional basketball players.
Aho, Queen Bee.
She nodded to him, and he swung the door open. She refilled my glass. You paying for the noble savage?
Yep.
He's working undercover.
He stood on the snow-laden sidewalk and raised his arms to the brief strands of sunshine cascading down on Maine. His arms stayed stretched out, the duster splayed like wings, and the dark hair dropped across the black leather to the small of his back. He looked like a 6.5-foot raven, gleaning what warmth he could from the available light in a full technicolor moment.
"He looks it."
The war cry rattled the glass in the closed door. Gerard and Straub was the premier law office in the county, having been started by Jim Gerard and Larry Straub back before LexisNexis and an hourly rate above $200. I was more comfortable in the old place, with its partners' desks and tortoiseshell lamps and quiet-voiced men. There used to be a remarkable mount of a bugling elk that Larry had taken up near Rock Creek before it became unfashionable to sport such things on the wall of a law office. The elk, of course, was gone, and all I saw were walnut-paneled walls with tasteful watercolors of the area carefully illuminated by recessed lighting.
"Good to see you, Walt."
"Hello, Kyle. Thanks for letting me sit in."
"No problem."
Sarcasm was lost on the man. "Where is everybody?"
"They're in the conference room upstairs. I just wanted to check a few things with you before we went in."
He stood there for a moment, nodded, and looked at the wall-to-wall carpeting.
"If I were to give you a copy of the will now, would you still feel compelled to participate in the reading?"
This was an unexpected turn. "Why would you do that?"
He crossed his arms and sat on the corner of his desk. "I have been in communication with both Kay and Carol."
He hugged himself a little tighter and continued.
"With the will being what it is, I think it might be best for all concerned if you were not present at the time of the reading."
I gave Kyle my undivided attention.
"And why is that?" "I think they may become agitated."
He handed me a closed manila envelope with the firm's address neatly affixed in the upper left-hand corner. His eyes came up to mine.
"You might tell Lana that I'll be by later with a copy for her."
I nodded, but as I opened the door leading from Kyle's office to the hallway from the reception area, what looked to be the entire Barroja, Lofton, Calloway clan was headed our way. Since Kyle had not appeared on time, they had decided to go looking for him en masse. Kay was in the lead, sweeping and clattering jewelry as she came, husband in tow. A blousier version of Kay, with a few more pounds of bosom, was bringing up the rear in a full-length mink coat and what looked like a full-body tan. I rolled up the envelope and stuffed it in my coat pocket.
"Hello?"
Kay pulled up a stride away and looked past me.
"Is this the reason we've been cooling our heels in your conference room?"
I leaned over and blocked her view. "I had some official business with Mr. Straub. I'm sorry for any inconvenience." She stared directly at the manila tube sticking from my coat pocket.
"Is that the will?"
I turned to look at Kyle, figuring it was his play. But Kay actually started to snag the envelope from my pocket. I suppose if I'd had time to think about it, I wouldn't have grabbed her hand with so much force. She yanked back, and about $1,200 worth of silver, coral, and turquoise came off in my hand.
"You son of a bitch!"
I tried to give her her jewelry back, but she stepped away. I tried to hand it to her husband, but he backed away too. I was getting ready to hang the Barroja Lofton collection on the doorknob when Carol, at least I assumed she was Carol, extended her hand, so I deposited the bracelets with her. "I'm sorry, I—"
"You son of a bitch!"
Tears were welling in Kay's eyes, and she clutched her hand as if she had just pulled it from a number 16 bear trap. I had to admit it was a pretty good performance. I looked up and became aware of Henry standing with a young woman behind the Barrojas in the overcrowded hallway. The young woman pushed her way through the lawyers and held up a piece of paper in a freshly manicured hand.
"Division of Criminal Investigation. I'm looking for Sheriff Walter Longmire."
She was a tall redhead, long-legged with an athletic figure and frighteningly direct gray eyes. That would be me. She turned to regard me as the very red, full lips kicked to one side in painful annoyance.
"I just flew through a blizzard to get up here at your request, Mr. Longmire. The least you could have done was to meet me at the airport."
I looked up at the stone-faced Indian behind her as she stared at the ceiling and expulsed a strong gust of dissatisfaction.
"Do you mind if we head back to your office to get me up to speed on things?"
If the Barojas had looked a little closer, they might have seen that the paper she was holding was an airline itinerary. When we got to the steps leading to the parking lot, she paused and cut loose with a toothsome grin.
"Hello, Daddy."
Chapter 9. You identified yourself as Division of Criminal Investigation. She sat in the chair opposite my desk with her expensive Italian boots curled around its front legs, something she had done with her feet since first grade.
"No, I didn't. I simply stated Division of Criminal Investigation, period. And then I said I was looking for you."
She smiled and sipped the coffee Ruby had given her as she studied the will. I looked over at Henry, who was sitting in the other chair, and at Ruby hovering in the doorway. Neither of them was going to be of any help. She glanced up, but not at me.
"Ruby, can you believe he hasn't said a word to me about how good I look?"
Ruby shook her head.
"Shameful. Honey, you look great." "Thank you."
She flicked her eyes at me before returning to the document. The phone rang, and Ruby disappeared after giving me a warning look. I glanced back at my daughter. "You can get into a lot of trouble."
"You can get into a lot of trouble manhandling lawyers. But you don't see me dressing you down, do you?"
She took another sip of her coffee, careful not to muss her lipstick.
"Can you believe that woman was actually going to grab the will out of Dad's pocket?"
She turned.
"For a professional, that seems like suspicious behavior, if you ask me."
I sighed and looked at my nameplate on the door, desperately trying to convince myself that I was there, even though no one seemed to be hearing me. "Does that will say what I think it does?" She cocked her head to one side and placed the Denver Broncos coffee cup on my desk.
"The testatrix, Marie Barroja, has bequeathed specifically a very large portion of tangible personal wealth and property to the beneficiary hereafter known as Lana Barroja."
The lips pursed again.
"Your little baker with the broken head is now a multimillionaire."
"What about the twins?"
Her mouth kicked to the side again. "Well, they didn't get chicken feed, but in comparison..." She looked up. "They got chicken feed."
"They'll contest it."
"They can try. It's not my field of expertise, but it looks like a good will, a revocable living trust with Marie as the trustee, and all properties placed in the trust. Lana is the appointed successor trustee with very specific duties on how the inheritance should be divided. I guess with this amount of money, Ms. Barroja was trying to avoid probate."
She flipped through the pages.
"It's been transposed from the handwritten original, but that's included."
She turned the pages around and showed me.
"Marie Barroja had beautiful handwriting."
"Who attested it?"
"Two people, which is pretty much standard."
She searched through the signing portions of the document.
"Kyle, I can't make this out."
"Straub?"
"That's it."
"Her lawyer. Who's the other one?"
She smiled. "Uncle Lucian."
I was getting ready to take my hat off, but froze as Henry and I looked at each other. "Does it make any difference if she was married and then divorced from one of the witnesses?" She continued to scan the papers in her lap.
"The Barroja woman was married to this Straub character?"
Neither Henry nor I said anything, and after a moment, she looked up, her eyes wide.
"No way! Uncle Lucian?"
I went ahead and tossed my hat on my desk. "I'll give you the details later. If it was annulled, does it make any difference?" She shrugged.
"Not if the annulment was legal. If it wasn't, it would still be an abandoned marriage, and any subsequent marriage would undercut any previous claim."
She looked back at the figures on the papers.
"He should have stayed married to her."
"I don't believe he had much choice in the matter." I stayed quiet for a moment.
It all keeps pointing back to the daughters, doesn't it?
I listened to the phone ring in the other room and hoped it was Vic.
Katie watched me and anticipated my next question. Are you wondering who gets the money if the little baker should meet with unforeseen circumstance?
It was on my mind.
She looked back at the will. The sisters. Henry shifted his weight in the chair and looked at me.
Are there other family members?
Well, there's the priest, who is Marie Baroja's cousin.
Marie Baroja's father had three brothers, and they only had one other child among them?
He studied me.
For a very Catholic family, that strikes me as unusual.
He waited for a moment.
How about Charlie Nerburn?
Who's Charlie Nerburn? She'd been watching us like a tennis match. It's a long story.
I believe he is just the sort that might have angry little bastards strung all up and down the Powder River.
I looked back at my daughter. Stepchildren? Nope, not unless adopted and stated in the will.
Ruby appeared in the doorway.
Vic, line two.
She disappeared.
I punched the conference button.
Absaroka County Sheriff's Department, Sheriff Walt Longmire speaking. How can I help you? I thought I'd give Sancho's methods a try.
What the fuck?
I guess it lost something in the translation.
What have you got for me? We have a problem.
I stared at the phone. You mean, besides the murder and the two attempted murders?
The can of Metamucil is missing.
I continued to stare at the little red light on the phone.
You've got to be kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. And they're having a shit hemorrhage over here. You'd think that somebody stole one of the Dead Sea Scrolls or something.
What the hell happened to it?
Jennifer Felsen saw it yesterday. Jesus, Walt, it's a can of Metamucil. I can't believe our case is hinging on this.
I started wondering what exactly our case was hinging on. I guess I need to come over to the old folks' home.
The line went dead, so I punched the button and looked at my daughter, just shy of 6 feet, most of it leg. She ate like a tiger shark, but never broke over 135 pounds.
I bet you're hungry.
Famished.
She smiled, but it faded quickly.
I'd rather not eat at the home.
I looked over at Henry. Do you mind? He glanced at her and then back to me.
Dinner with beautiful learned counsel?
He sighed.
I suppose not.
I helped her with her coat and looked down at her. You've only been here for a few hours, and I'm already pawning you off. She put her arms around me and rested her head on my chest as I breathed in the scent of her hair.
Daddy, I know what I'm going to get you for Christmas.
What? She looked up at me through mascara'd lashes.
A razor.
I remembered all the hours we'd spent napping when she was a baby, her tiny body only covering a quarter of my chest, how she didn't speak for the first year and a half of her life, and how it seemed that she'd been trying to catch up ever since. She pulled back and smiled as I lowered a fuzzy cheek for a soft kiss.
I love you.
I love you, too. It's wonderful to have you home.
I let her go and watched as she swirled around the corner toward Ruby. Henry turned back after she was gone, and I reached for my hat.
How in the world did you get Katie a flight up from Denver? Omar's Lear. He says the labor is gratis, but that you owe him for the fuel. Merry Christmas.
He took a deep breath.
I suppose the bee is the only place open.
Lucky Dorothy, getting to see you twice in one day. What an embarrassment of riches.
It took me a little more than 5 minutes to get over to the Den of Iniquity. I had stopped off and bought a six-pack as a peace offering for Lucian. I figured I was going to run into him before too long, and it was better to be wrong with beer than just wrong. I sat there in the parking lot of the home, watching the ever-present Wyoming wind kick at the ridges of the drifts like a gale cutting the tops off waves. I sat there on my heated seat with the defrosters on high and stared at my mountains. I had liked California. It was a beautiful place. But my spirit developed a restlessness there that I couldn't seem to shake. I had liked Vietnam, except that native peoples were shooting at you all the time, kind of like Wyoming in the 1870s.
I gazed at the mountains and allowed my eyes to relax into the monochromatic landscape where the earth blended with the sky. There was a faint glow separating the two firmaments near Black Tooth, and it was almost like the moon had gotten hung up on the crumbling granite incisor. I sighed, switched off the ignition, stuffed the keys in my coat pocket, and began to trudge into the home. When I got inside, the place was in turmoil with the soothing strains of Dean Martin's Silver Bells in the background. Vic was talking with Jennifer Felsen, who always seemed on the verge of tears. I figured it was time to do a little social damage control. I collapsed in a seat after I sat the brown paper bag of beer under the chair closest to me. "I didn't bring the rubber hoses. Do you think we can find some here?" Jennifer smiled, but still clutched a tattered Kleenex in her lap with shaking hands as her eyes continued to fill. "You know, they got Capone with a can of Metamucil." I studied the wall, trying to give Jennifer a little room. "You saw the container yesterday?" She nodded. "Who's been in contact with it since then?" She slumped into her chair and sobbed. "The entire staff. Anybody." I looked over at Vic, who seemed to be on her very last nerve. "You can check with the others?" She nodded, but didn't say anything, which was probably for the best, and went back to her reports. I watched Jennifer for a moment, letting her purge the ducts. "Now, Joe Leskey would have worked last night. Who worked today?"
"Shelley Gatton."
"Is she already gone?" Vic interrupted. "Lewis called her, and she's on her way in." Joe Leskey didn't answer his phone, but Lewis said that that's not unusual, since he sleeps through the afternoon and might not get the message until he gets up to come here. After Jennifer had gone, I leaned against the back of my chair and perused the AARP posters. I figured I'd let Vic start, just to see if her line of thought was the same as mine.
"This makes no fucking sense."
I threw my arm over the back of the chair Jennifer had occupied. "Why would anybody go to the trouble of taking the can?" I didn't really feel like getting up from my chair. "I guess I better go by Lucian's and take my beating. I haven't even told him that Marie was poisoned." I stood up and tried to think of the last time I'd taken my coat off.
"You look like shit."
I adjusted my hat, just this side of jaunty. "That's when I do my best work, when people are underestimating me. Check the supply closet if you haven't already. Maybe the Metamucil is there. You can take a statement from Shelley Gatton and from Joe Leskey when they get here?"
"Yeah." She changed the subject. "Katie make it in?"
I nodded. "So you were in on it?" She was already back to her reports.
"Everybody was in on it."
I picked up my beer and left. Some detective. The door was closed to room 32 when I got there, and no light was showing from under the sill. I checked my pocket watch, but it was too early for bed. I went ahead and knocked. Nothing. So I knocked again. Somebody moved in the room.
"I got a gun."
"Me too." I tried the knob, but the door was locked. In 15 years of visiting him, he had never locked the door. "Lucian, what are you doing in there?" No answer. I leaned against the wall and gauged how much energy it would take to kick the door in. I was tired and didn't feel like kicking indoors, so I went down to the end of the hall and got a passkey. Dean had moved on to Winter Wonderland, his voice gliding like a sleigh on cream cheese. Jennifer wanted to accompany me, but I wanted Lucian alone. "Lucian, I'm unlocking the door and coming in." It took a moment for him to respond.
"Go to hell."
He said he had a gun, and I believed him. I unlocked and stood just to the side in case he was drunk enough to shoot. I brushed my fingertips across the door as the slab of light from the hallway bolted across the sand-colored carpet. The first thing to hit me was the smell. At some time during his vigilance, he must have soiled himself, and that smell overrode the tang of his unwashed body, the high heat of the room, and the bourbon. He was seated in a cowhide high-backed chair with a 10-gauge sawed-off coach gun across his lap. Both hammers were pulled. "Lucian,
go away."
The empty bottle of Pappy Van Winkle's Family Reserve was on the floor next to his artificial leg. He was wearing his tattered, checked bathrobe, his Stetson, and one cowboy boot. There were no lights on, and the chair had been pulled against the wall. "What are you up to, Lucian?" I put the beer down by the door, which I closed, and crossed to stand in front of the brindle sofa against the other wall. I took my jacket off and tossed it behind me. "It's hot in here."
"Where?"
"It's hot. You mind if I open the outside door?" He watched me, then took his fingers from the shotgun long enough to gesture toward the sliding glass. I slid the heavy, double-paned glass back about a foot and took a deep breath. The miniature, multicolored lights blinked around Lucian's patio, flashing blue, green, red, and yellow across the icicles on the canopy and across the dimpled surface of snow that had dumped into the small bowl at the back of the building. There was a claptrap Datsun pickup parked in the closest spot of the elevated parking area. The motor was running, but there wasn't anybody in it. Probably somebody warming his truck up for the cold ride home. I went back and sat on the sofa opposite Lucian and picked up the empty bourbon bottle. "You been drinking?" He snorted.
"Drinking hell, I'm drunk."
I nodded and watched his fingers still on both triggers. "Scattergun out for a reason?" The smell was getting to me, so I breathed through my mouth. He wobbled a little, attempting to think and sit still at the same time. He stared at a space to my left, but I was pretty sure he was still talking to me.
"I'm waiting."
The glittering mahogany of his dark eyes was still visible in the gloom of the unlit room.
"You wait with me?"
"You bet." I sat back in the sofa and wished I had one of the beers in the paper bag, but one drunk and armed sheriff in the room was enough. I scratched my face, felt the hair, and tried to remember the last time I'd trimmed my beard. I reached out with my foot and nudged the prosthetic leg. "Maybe while we're waiting, we should get you cleaned up and put your leg on." He was quiet for a while, staring at the floor between us.
"You can't keep him safe, you know."
His eyes straight up to mine where they wobbled.
"Not always."
I thought about the woman who had died in room 42.